You are listening to a Science Actually production.
So, on July the 8th, 1944, the joke was first told to the enemy in the Ardennes.
Squad! Tell the...
So that mug reminds me of what was the name of that cartoon show, Real Monsters? Did you ever watch that as a kid?
No.
I don't know the one you're talking about. I have seen like those like fluffy dolls with the spiky teeth that Gen Alpha was obsessed with for a while. I can't remember the name of them.
Oh, those new things. Yeah.
Those were terrifying.
Yeah. Well, that's what I had in mind when I was making it.
Nice.
Nailed it.
Okay. Nothing scares people more than like looking at you while you're taking a sip from your mug and just like being accosted. Yeah.
I just started at my last job, the last job I had, and I'm getting the tour and I'm walking around and blah, 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 blah. And I was shown the kitchen and there's all these personalized, customized coffee mugs there. And they say, just grab any mug you want and make yourself a coffee. And that's it. And so my very first day, I went to the kitchen and hello, 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 grabbed the mug, made a coffee, went to a meeting room with a bunch of people. And I'm sitting there and listening, taking notes, getting to know everyone, drinking from my coffee. And every time I take a sip, the whole room is just laughing. And I don't know why. It's because it said badass bitch on it. And I had no idea because it was a white mug and it was written in light pink. So I just glossed over it and I didn't notice. And everyone called me a badass bitch for a few months.
Oh, that would be a great gag gift if you could get like something
heat
like
activated?
That. Where, yeah. It's heat activated. And it's, well, like it's on the bottom as well. So you can't, even if you do try to check, because you've had an experience like Benjamin. Oh, gosh. Okay, so folks, listeners of the podcast, of The Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist podcast, I am extremely excited about the guest that we have this week, because it's... I feel like it's something that like nerds and scientists can unite with their shared love of lasers. Whether that's lasers in, you know, practical uses for welding or astronomy or telecommunications, all of which we'll try to cover. Or like if you're coming from the nerd side and you just love everything that's like nerdy and lasery about any sci-fi that you've ever seen. In all time. So very, very lucky to have with us today, Cameron Jones, to talk to us about all of these things. Cameron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, welcome. So what makes the lasers go pew, pew?
I think thought about this before. I've never seen a laser which makes a pew, pew noise, but the high power ones make a crack noise. So there's something there. You can make them make noise.
Ah, there is a noise.
I do wonder where that came from.
Pew pew.
Like there has to have been the first person in the world of sci-fi to have decided that that's the name, that's the onomatopoeia that lasers make. And I wonder why they got it so wrong, because crack sounds nothing like that.
I don't know. Crack. I like the crack.
Well, this is extremely contrived. If I had to like try and think of a reason why it might make noise, you could say, oh, it's the inductors and capacitors discharging and recharging, because inductors make a little whirring noise when you discharge them, right? So maybe it's something in the back end electronics. That's how you would justify it, I reckon, if you're trying to write a crunchy sci-fi.
There you go. Where did the pew-pew come from? Yeah. We heard it here. I love it. Uncovering truths.
That would surely be a topic for a PhD thesis.
Like, yeah.
The history of science and sci-fi. What makes things go pew-pew. And so you're currently doing your PhD at Australian National University on the topic of free space optics communication. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful. And I think no matter which acronym I choose to use, someone will not find it clear because there's like five acronyms. Essentially, the short version of what I do is I use lasers to talk to spacecraft, or I'm trying to.
Okay.
How is that better than sending commands via radio or another frequency? So laser just has more information in it?
Basically? Yeah, so the way you would normally talk to spacecraft is using radio because we figured out how to use radio waves, I don't know, over 100 years ago? Yeah, well over 100 years ago, and they're easy. To give a general idea of the kind of speed difference between going from radio to laser is the copper wire our internet used to come in uses radio wavelength, electromagnetic waves. The optic fibers that your internet comes in these days uses optical frequency. So we're kind of looking at going from telephone wire speeds to internet speeds to space is the kind of speed up we're hoping for.
What is the bandwidth, I guess you could say, like going up and coming down from space? So I know we've talked about previously in other episodes, telescopes that are just gathering just incredible terabytes of information, but they can only send down some of it. So what is it?
Yeah, so
what kind of information are we getting?
So my favorite anecdote about the telescopes is the NASA's hyperspectral imaging suite, a camera pointed back down towards Earth. They download 30 gigabytes of data off that thing every day, but it generates 300 gigabytes every day. So it turns out what they actually have to do is they save all the data onto portable hard drives and then just fill up the astronauts' pockets with these portable hard drives when they take the rocket back down. And that turns out to be the most efficient way of doing it these days. So we need more speed. The most impressive demonstration we've seen so far of the downlink from space to Earth would be NASA's T-Bird missions, where I think they've cracked 30 terabytes in a 10-minute pass. So they got this basically a tissue box bolted to the back of a low-Earth orbit satellite, and just in the 10 minutes it burst down, 30 terabytes.
And I guess compared to like the data rates that people can get on Earth, that's significantly slower, right? Compared to like something you'd get from a fiber optic cable.
Yeah, like the like data centers that your internet runs through is still doing terabytes per second through the fiber networks.
Right.
But we're approaching those speeds wirelessly, which is very exciting.
That's kind of so cool. How fast is the internet for the astronauts on the space station? I assume they can send in emails, but can they watch Netflix or YouTube?
That's a good question. I actually don't know what their current speeds are.
Oh, okay.
I've got no idea. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just wondering. You're talking about speeds up there. I'm like, huh.
Yeah.
Could I actually have that written in my list of intelligent questions?
I'm wondering if there's, because you were saying that radio telecommunications have been around for over a century. But we knew about, non-radio wavelength light much earlier than we knew about radio wavelength light. Were there kind of like earlier attempts to do this sort of thing, like optical communication, like beyond just like lighting torches on mountaintops?
Yeah, so there's a very niche application that everyone talks about, or everyone in my field puts in the first chapter of their PhD, called the photophone, which was invented by Alexander Graham Bell in 1880. And it was like got the sunlight coming in through the sunlight in the roof and then a shutter, and he could automatically open and close that and try to use that for some kind of free space optical comms that didn't really go anywhere, but that is technically the birth of our research was, yeah, some guy shuttering sunlight open and close to transmit data.
Okay,
cool. So he got 200 meters on that distance.
I think if the distance of your communication is comparable to the distance that you could like yell or like hold up a really big sign.
Yeah. Probably it's sort of the only thing you could do properly once you got lasers.
I think Benjamin had like a whole bunch of questions about what was real and what was not real of like the lasers that we do see in
science fiction. About this question? It's a two-sided question. One, what is the most accurate, what would you say is the most accurate representation of a laser in a movie? And then the flip side of that, what would you consider the most wildly this is not what lasers do at all depiction in a movie?
To be completely honest, I can't think of a single particularly accurate depiction. I think the most common misconception is that we really like using red or green lasers. You know, you use the red laser if you're the good guys and the green laser if you're the bad guys. I don't know why we color code the good guys and bad guys, but when we're doing this actual work, we typically use infrared lasers. So they're totally invisible, which kind of makes it hard for us to sell when we're trying to do our outreach work. So on all of our PowerPoint slides, we get the red crayon out and draw lasers coming out of our photos to show people where the laser is because you can't see it in real life.
Okay.
I wonder, yeah, I think the color thing is maybe like, you know, cinematic, kind of like to show the theme of this color is good and this color is bad. But yeah, now that I think about it, they're almost always visible light. So why is it that infrared light is the kind of the choice wavelength that you guys go for?
So there's a few different reasons here. Because our work actually uses a different infrared light to the laser weaponry people who also use infrared but a different wavelength. So what we use in our telecommunications work is 1550 nanometers light, so 1.5 micrometers. And we use that because there happens to be a nice sweet spot where it doesn't get absorbed by water. There's lots of water in the atmosphere, so the fact that we can find a nice window that we can pass through is convenient, and we can shoot that up into space. It's also convenient that all the telecommunications people have been working on this wavelength for their own reasons for ages, so I've got lots of amplifiers there. But the laser weaponry people use 1064 nanometer light, so 1 micrometer. And they use that because that happens to be the wavelength that you can build really high power amplifiers for. So that makes sense. If you can build a really powerful laser, that's the wavelength you're going to use. But there's a really funny problem with that wavelength. And it's that wavelength specifically happens to be the most eye unsafe wavelength possible. And talking about the eye safety of laser weaponry seems insane, but there is actually very good reason to worry about it.
But if it's in a wavelength that you can't see, how has it become an eye safety issue? It's just the material
exactly.
In your eye evaporates.
So if you think about visible light, we can see it because we've got rods and cones tuned in our eyeballs for that light, but also our eyes will focus it onto our retina. When I'm using this 1550 nanometer light, that gets blocked at the cornea. So it won't get focused at all, so it's relatively eye safe. But at this 1064 wavelength that the laser weaponry people are working at, it will get focused to your retina, but you won't be able to see it. So if you happen to catch a glance of the laser beam, your blink reflex won't kick in, and then your eyes will, I don't know, pop or turn into the milky fish eye or something. So it's pretty grim.
Gross.
But cool. And because these laser weaponry people are working at really high powers, it turns out that the distance at which you can accidentally blind a bystander ends up being something like 10 kilometers from the thing that you're shooting.
Wow.
Which is really scary for them. So they're actually trying to figure out how to build different wavelength laser weapons to maybe pose less of a risk to anyone who happens to be within 10 kilometers of the thing they're shooting.
This is going to be a bit niche, but this is reminding me of the Monty Python skit about the world's most deadly joke.
Yeah.
And how, like, all of these, like, you know, secret people were working on, you know, trying to craft the most deadly joke that could be read in World War II over megaphones or something to defeat the Axis powers. And, like, they had to like, work on it separately, and, like, no person was allowed to see more than two lines at once, otherwise they'd be... It's like, the weapon itself, just the development is so dangerous.
Yeah, one guy translated three words and he was wounded, and then he had to
be
taken to hospital or something.
Wow. Okay. This is pretty intense. And yes. So I'm wondering, like, the big challenge. So you said that at the wavelength that you're working at what was it, 1.5 microns?
Yeah, that's right.
So there's a sweet spot there where it wouldn't interfere with water droplets. I'm assuming that there's, like, a lot of other kind of adaptive optics, like atmospheric corrections and things that you still need to correct for. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that ends up being the bulk of my research, actually. So when it comes to just pointing lasers in the right direction, that ends up being, I don't know, maybe slightly easier than you'd expect. I don't know how to do it, but I know that the people at NASA can point a laser wherever they want. So they've figured it out. And that's how... So when it comes to satellite-to-satellite laser communications, we've been doing that routinely for quite a while. I think SpaceX puts 30 petabytes per day through their satellite-to-satellite laser network. But wow. It's, getting the laser from the satellite to the ground ends up being really difficult because of all that atmosphere in the way. So we need some kind of way to compensate for the atmosphere, and that's what my research is in. So you said the name of the topic correctly, actually, Kobe, where you use what's called adaptive optics, which is a system where you measure how the light got deformed and all messed up from the atmosphere, and then you have a little other device to correct for it in real time, and you're doing about 1,000 corrections a second is what you're aiming for.
Oh, wow.
That's crazy. When you're sending information via laser towards a satellite, those are moving pretty freaking fast. How do you... Do you, like, send a laser straight up and hope that in that brief moment that it passes, that's enough information? Or do you have to, like, track it and keep shooting at it? Aiming.
Yeah, shooting's fine. So that touches on the other very difficult problem, actually. So if the satellite is in geostationary orbit, that's relatively easy because you just look up where the satellite is and you point your laser there, and that gets you most of the way there. And you can even run your adaptive optics to correct that. But because a satellite in low Earth orbit is moving so quickly compared to our reference point, you actually need to point the laser beam a little bit ahead of the satellite. So we can do the orbital dynamics and maths to figure out where you need to point the laser compared to where you're seeing the satellite to compensate for it. But if you're trying to do adaptive optics, that gets really difficult because it turns out the laser, the atmospheric path the incoming beam comes in from is actually totally different to the atmospheric path your transmitting laser goes to. So you actually need to run two different adaptive optics loops to compensate for two different parts of the atmosphere. And wow. It becomes very complex.
Wow.
Oh, well, I never thought about that, actually, that your path would be different on the way in.
Huh.
This is, yeah, it's kind of blowing my mind.
It is. You have to.
On every level, there's a new problem you discover.
You have to pinpoint that something that's very small and possibly moving very, very fast. And you have to compensate for two different directions instantaneously. That sounds
exactly.
Superman.
And also the signal beacon, like the radio beacon that you give off, isn't always totally accurate. So you also need a second telescope tracking the satellite itself as well with a zoomed out view so that you know exactly where the satellite is. So you've got three telescopes all operating in unison trying to make the system work.
How far apart are the telescopes?
They're usually all bolted to one big telescope. So the telescope we use for our work is a big 70 centimeter diameter telescope. And then we've got a transmitter telescope bolted on top of that. And then just a much smaller tracking telescope bolted to the other side of it. And the tracking telescope is kind of zoomed out so that we can see the whole satellite at once and keep it in the center of frame. The big 70 centimeter one is focused exactly on the transmit port of the satellite. And then the transmit telescopes are pointed where we need them to go.
That's crazy.
I mean, the implications for sci-fi from everything you're saying are huge, right? Like, it's not just in terms of, like, if you're trying to shoot a laser through any sort of atmosphere or air or something that's not, like, a perfect vacuum, you have to have adaptive optics or some sort of system to correct for that. But not only that, like, space battles would look super boring because it'd all be at infrared wavelengths and you wouldn't see anything.
Yeah, you're just like watching two ships kind of floating in space and then suddenly the dodging armor plating on one starts evaporating. And don't even know where they're getting shot from.
Huh. My next question was gonna ask you, how far can the laser signal go before it starts degrading? But at the same time, going back to the laser battle question, if I shot a laser that you couldn't see but could potentially evaporate your hull, and I missed, how far would that thing go before it just spreads out enough that it doesn't cause damage? Because I could shoot that thing potentially millions of kilometers away, far, far away from where the battle was. It's just this little pinprick of death just going through the universe.
Forever.
So how far...
So it depends a lot on whether you're shooting the laser from in space or from within an atmosphere. I'll talk about in space first. So laser beams still follow the inverse square law, which means if you double the distance, you quarter the power. So they dissipate relatively quickly from wherever you put the focal point. So you won't have a pinprick of death killing someone on Andromeda, thankfully. I can't tell you an exact number because it depends on your lens system and all sorts of things, but, you know, it drops off very quickly, inverse square law. If you're in an atmosphere, the air causes you more and more problems. The laser weaponry people are always dealing with a problem they're calling thermal blooming, which is basically when they shoot these laser weapons, the power density of the laser gets so big that it starts heating up the air, and that expands the beam and increases the absorption, and that kind of creates a cascading reaction. So the range on laser weapons in an atmosphere is actually really quite short because it just heats up the air so much, and then the air distorts the signal, which causes more heating.
So that Death Star thing doesn't go, it's not going to work. Unless it's
like, oh, if you ramp up the power enough.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. That, like, the whole idea with the laser beam is that it's meant to be beamed, right? It's meant to be coherent. And then the fact that it's interacting with particles is basically causing it to fracture outwards as it interacts with stuff, right?
Yeah, so that's why both in sci-fi and in real life, actually, they always use pulsed lasers for their laser weapons instead of a continuous laser. So a continuous wave laser is the one that you like see, and it's just a constant laser beam versus the pulsed, like a laser blaster or whatever. And it turns out, both in real life and in sci-fi, that a continuous laser is good at melting things. But if you're trying to blast a hole in something, then melting isn't quite the action you want. But instead, what a pulse laser can do is when the first pulse hits the thing, it will create a tiny little ball of plasma. And then when the second pulse hits that ball of plasma, that plasma will absorb all the light and then get hit further into the armor plating. And then the next pulse comes and it kind of drills all the way down rather than melting. You kind of create a little plasma drill. And that's how pulse lasers work.
Is that a thing that people actually use for practical applications, plasma drills?
So they don't call it a plasma drill, but that's how laser cutting works with a pulsed laser. Because if you just try and melt it normally, like you might with a, cheaper laser cutter, then you get that kind of blobby mess on the sides of whatever you're cutting. Whereas if you use a pulsed laser, you can kind of create this tiny little plasma ball which shoots all the way through.
I like the pulse drill thing. We need to change that.
Yeah.
Anything with lasers in it, I think by definition, needs to have a cool name. If you can't cook
up exactly. For it, you just should move on.
We do love good acronyms, scientists. Yeah. I feel like at a certain point, they just get more and more convoluted, though. I was going to ask, so you came from a like physics and applied math background, right? How did you decide to apply that mathematics specifically in this direction of like adaptive optics and lasers?
So I kind of fell into it backwards, which I think is the path a lot of people take with their career. Because I did my Bachelor's of Science at the University of Sydney, where I did my honours research in Majorana fermion-based quantum computing in 2020. And that was a really exciting year to be working on Majorana fermions because Microsoft hadn't retracted all their experimental papers yet. but after that, I kind of was a little bit disenchanted about the quantum computing world and wanted to start working and found myself working at Finisar, which is a laser technology company in Sydney, where I was working on lab instruments, building holograms, which is its own cool side of things I can talk about.
Very cool.
But when I was at Finisar, they put me on a project looking on the feasibility of inter-satellite laser links and how you can switch between them to make a more resilient network. And I was like, that is so cool. I need to keep on working on that. And then I decided to go do my PhD on that.
Very cool. It is kind of funny how like academic paths get carved out by just finding like one cool thing and just immediately falling in love with it.
Exactly, yeah.
I wonder what this does. Oh, cool. I'm going to do it forever.
Yeah.
I mean, people ask me like why I got into radio astronomy rather than any other astronomy. It was like I happened to talk to a guy and he told me about radio supernovae, and that's where I... Everything just followed from that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Benjamin, if I'm going to be stealing your question.
Go ahead.
But I think I have to ask about lightsabers.
I got that in there. Go ahead.
Our audience wants to know. What?
Forget the audience. Like, I want to know. I'm kidding, audience. Go ahead.
Like feasibility or... or closest like realistic practical version? Like what when you see a lightsaber, do you
first
just
of all,
immediately
is a lightsaber
go,
a laser?
I cannot think of a how you could possibly build a lightsaber using lasers. I feel like maybe plasma physics might be a more possible way of building a lightsaber, but that might be because I know nothing about plasma. But like, you know, maybe if you can use like a crazy magnetic field to contain a like beam of plasma, that would work, but I don't know how you would make it work with lasers.
Okay. So that's a no.
Why do,
damn it.
Well, then why do cats, how about this? Why do cats love laser pointers so much?
I think it's the same reason I love lasers. Activates the cool novelty part of your brain. You have a jump.
Sorry, is this what like lunch breaks look like in your department? Just, all the scientists chasing a laser.
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, that's amazing. I wanted to ask you about SETI. I know that that's a topic that you're a little bit interested in. So when you think about SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, in terms of lasers, either things that we can do, signals we can emit from Earth or signals we could detect from other civilizations or aliens, what do you think is like the most promising approach in, you know, the next decade or two?
Ooh. So look, SETI is well outside my professional research, but I happen to be reading a book right now talking about that, so I can pretend I'm an expert. But I've been reading Life as No One Knows It by Sarah Amari Walker. Shout out to anyone who wants to read the book. But their hypothesis is they're trying to build a like physics mathematical framework for measuring complexity of things, which sounds like they wrapped all the way back around to intelligent design with all the evolution deniers, but they've got math behind it. And the idea is if you can find some molecules on another planet which are sufficiently complex, then you can use thermodynamics to prove that you can't get that by random chance, in the same way that it's very unlikely that all the air molecules are going to suddenly get sucked to the left-hand side of your bedroom. It is unlikely that you'll get DNA molecules by chance. So they're trying to invent some kind of way of describing how complex things are to prove that. So that's what I'm interested in currently.
It is funny, this tendency for people who spend all day doing science to, in their free time, also do
science. Absolutely.
Yes.
But in terms of receiving alien signals, I read a really interesting hypothesis, which might have even been out of UCID. I can't remember who published it. But their argument was that the reason why we haven't heard any alien signals yet is because the aliens aren't talking to us, basically. Because it turns out if you want to do quantum communications with lasers, you need really big telescopes because you need to capture 99% of the photons which get sent out. So if all the aliens are talking to each other using quantum communication schemes, they can just look at us and see that, oh, well, they don't have a telescope big enough to even hear our signal, so we won't bother talking to them.
Not worth their time. It's wild.
Yeah, because I think they did the math that if you wanted to shoot a quantum signal between us and the next nearest star, you would need a telescope 100 kilometers wide to capture all the signal.
Jeez. Whew. That's what we should put on the far side of the moon. See?
Yeah.
We talked about that before. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, put it to use.
Just sitting there doing nothing.
It's just hovering there.
Yeah.
Not hovering. I know it's hovering.
All right. Benjamin, you had a special segment prepared for this episode.
Well, you're going to have to run it because you have the controls on your end.
Mm. Right.
Right.
Okay.
So we're going to let you listen to a few lasers, and you tell us what that laser is.
Okay, I'm going to go horribly at this. I can say that from the beginning, but go ahead.
Go for it.
All right.
It's going to be. This is good. Let's see what you got.
Okay, I'm going to go with the first one. Okay. Any ideas?
Did it come from a kid's toy?
It did. It was on a kid's toy, but it comes from a movie. They made a toy of it.
Oh. Got no idea. I could just start naming sci-fi movies, right? I'll get there eventually.
I'll stumble on it later.
All right, so to put you out of your misery, that one was from Mars Attacks.
Don't even know the movie to begin with.
Oh, you need to watch it. There's so much laser goodness in it. And okay. It's funny.
Okay. I'll go with an easy one.
Next. Okay, please.
All right. Okay, let's have a listen to this next one.
Okay. I can say Star Wars. I feel good about that one.
Yes. Immediately.
Yes.
Good. Okay.
That is a Star Wars TIE fighter. Nicely done.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe a bit of a more tricky one for you.
Oh, I'm loving it.
Feels like it's not really good at once. Is it from a video game?
No, it's from a movie as well.
It's probably
a series of movies.
Yes.
Oh god, I've got no idea.
Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd.
Is this the bit where I need to really embarrassingly admit I've never watched Star Trek?
That's okay.
Does this get my license removed?
This is the Proton Pack from Ghostbusters.
Oh, God. Okay, I should have known that one.
All right, maybe this one, despite not knowing the movie franchise, you might still know.
The last one, the teleporter from Star Trek.
It is Star Trek, but it's not a teleporter.
So close. It was the phasers. The phasers. Blasters.
Yeah. Good. Last one.
Yeah. Last one to put you out of your misery.
All right.
Hopefully it'll be a bit easier.
Oh, I hope so. Okay, can say lightsaber. Is that 2 out of 5?
3 out of 5.
Oh, this is solid. Yeah, 3 out of 5.
Okay.
3 out of 5.
3.5.
All right, you can keep your nerd card. You're good. You got 50%. You're all right. You're good to stay.
Yeah.
It's a tough segment. I think most astronomers, most scientists would not necessarily recognize all of those.
Really? I'm thinking it sticks right up your alley. Come on.
I think it really depends. There are different kind of like niches for astronomers. Well, firstly, not all scientists. I don't know if this is your experience in undergrad, but like I found that like physicists were either like D&D physicists or rock climbing or bouldering physicists, right? These are the two types of physicists. And so I guess if you're more on like the bouldering, slacklining side of science, like you're not necessarily going to be that big into sci-fi.
Suppose. Yeah, and now my office is in Canberra. They're all bouldering type physicists. There's like two things to do in Canberra, and one of them is climbing a blockhouse.
Nice.
Okay, I'm going. I'll try that.
All right, Benjamin, before we switch over to our rapid fire round, were there any other burning questions that you had for Cameron?
Well,
the most burning of laser burning questions.
Okay. In the comic books, if Wolverine enters a room that has motion detecting lasers, he says he can stop because he can smell them. Because it sizzles the atmosphere enough that it creates ozone. What's that about?
Yeah, if you get oxygen hot enough, it'll create ozone. If I am being a boring scientist about it, I'm going to say that if you've got a laser strong enough to spontaneously create ozone in the atmosphere, you're probably not going to have a nice, super fine beam shooting across the room. You're probably going to have a messy torch kind of beam because it expands so much as the oxygen absorbs everything. But yeah, that's you can
thermal blossoming,
thermal blooming. Yeah,
yeah.
It'll probably be a horrible room to go into if it's
stinking.
It stings the nostrils.
Yeah.
So in all the movies, also, they have like the random lasers moving around because it's protecting a jewel or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can see the lasers. That's not reality. You're not going to see the lasers moving around.
You can see them once. If the laser beam is strong enough to see through the air, it's also strong enough to blind you immediately.
Got it. And how about the scenes in movies? Where there's like a laser grid protecting something and you can't see it, but then the very smart cat burglar emits some smoke or steam into the area where the lasers are passing through, and then you can kind of see them for a moment. Is there any legitimacy to that?
That works with a red laser or a green laser, but I have to question the security designers why they're using visible lasers for this when you've got perfectly good infrared lasers. Which would totally stumble that cat burglar.
There you go. Okay. I'm never going to
the movies. Unless it was a real cat. Again.
Yeah. Real your cat just gets distracted. Really smart burglar.
Oh, they could also see some infrared wavelengths, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, some animals can. I think that's the really close infrared, though. So I'm not sure if they can see the, like, wavelengths that I work with.
Okay. Interesting. The comment I was going to make before was just like a general one, again, going back to like the experience that physics undergrads have with lasers in terms of safety training versus everyone else. And like, I feel like for me, lasers have kind of stopped being as fun since that. Because it's just like drilled into you. Any lab that you go into, you have to do like lab training. And there's like, if there's a laser involved, it's like you have to wear protective goggles and you make sure that you're not at eye level with the laser. And it's just like the average person picks up a laser pointer that, you know, you would play around with for cats and just like would point it at you for fun or like, you know, point it at their friends or point it at a reflective surface. It's a very different world.
Yes, the eBay and AliExpress laser pointers scare the hell out of me these days. once I found out that it is significantly cheaper to make a powerful laser than it is to make a weak laser. So yeah, it turns out because like a powerful laser isn't actually that powerful in the grand scheme of things. We're talking about, you know, 1 watt is enough to blind someone, you know, a kilometer away. So high power lasers are quite low power in the scheme of things and turns out to be easier to make. So all the, you know, dodgy stuff you see on eBay and AliExpress are usually just high power lasers with a low power sticker on them. And they scare me.
I am checking my last internet purchase to make sure that I did not accidentally get a deadly laser.
I bought off of AliExpress a bunch of laser pointers for my son, and he had a great time just shooting them everywhere, even at us. And now you're making me think how close I came to my son permanently damaging his family. So I'm not doing that again. And he's been asking, and now I'm wondering why, if they have some nefarious plans. Oh boy.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Okay.
All right. So with that scary detail in mind, are you ready for our rapid fire round?
Ready as ever.
Okay.
Cool. We will not be rapidly firing lasers at you. So yeah. You do not.
Okay, good, good. Don't have to duck.
All right. What is first question? What is the weirdest thing that you believed as a kid?
Oh. God, I even watched the last episode to prepare, and I forgot to prepare for this rapid fire question. It's very unrapid.
Thank you for what?
I believed in Santa for like way too long because of that NORAD Santa tracker. It was, I don't know if you know the website I'm talking about, but that kind of reinforced my belief in Santa for probably longer than it should have. It's like the government can't lie about these things.
Oh, I love that Santa tracker.
Never lie to you.
It's phenomenal. Oh, God.
Amazing.
Which teacher had the biggest positive impact on you?
I gotta say, it was Dr. Gavin Gant, my year 11 and 12 physics teacher. He even commented on my LinkedIn post like last year, like, oh, I'm so proud of you, Cameron. I was like, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But he was kind of the first actual scientist I ever met. He did a bunch of nuclear physics as a working scientist and then decided to become a teacher. And it was the first time I could see, like, oh, I can do that. Maybe a bit of ego on me, but.
Oh, it's inspiration. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's very cool. And I've heard similar things from other people. And I don't think it's an ego thing. I think it's a recognition of like, this is a feasible career that people can do.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Well, there was ego in my case because my first assignment, which was like write a review of a scientific paper, I found a paper he published and wrote a report on that.
All right. Next question. What's one scientific discovery you wish you could have witnessed in person?
So the other book I've been reading recently is Everything is Tuberculosis by John Green. Oh, yeah. And he describes the very first conference in the kind of like late 1800s when they figured out that tuberculosis was bacteria. And at that point in human history, tuberculosis was killing a third of all humans. So I'm just imagining being in the room with all these scientists as they figured out that this thing that everyone thought was some genetic condition that gets everyone eventually was actually like a bacteria that we can treat with antibiotics.
Wow.
I think that would have been crazy.
Oof. Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay. That's cool. If you had to pick one historical scientist to go bowling with, who would it be?
Can I pick Tycho Brahe? Do you know some of the crazy stories about him? So I pick him as long as he brings his pet moose along.
He had a pet moose?
What?
He had a pet moose? Gold Nose had a pet moose? Oh, yeah. My God, this guy just got even cooler.
The pet moose became an alcoholic and actually passed away because the moose drank too much beer and then fell down the stairs, and that's how the moose died.
Sorry, that's not where I thought
really?
That was going.
Really?
Yes. The Incredible Life of Tinker Bray.
It's not that his moose became an alcoholic and died because of internal like liver damage or something reasonable like that. You may as well have said that like his moose became an alcoholic and then like got into a drunk driving accident.
Oh, well, you know that's how he lost his nose as well, right? So that's how Tycho Brahe lost his nose, was in a drunken midnight sword fight over who was the best mathematician with one of his undergrad friends.
That I knew. But the moose, oh my God. I'm so happy right now.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit in shock. All right. This is a more serious question. You were a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be?
Pesto, tomato, and bocconcini. Gotta get that zing.
Ooh. That's a solid, like a caprese.
Yeah, sandwich. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Nice.
Gotta get that good sourdough as well.
Oh, the bread's important. The bread's important.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What is your most controversial opinion about pizza?
The low-moisture mozzarella is way better than high-moisture mozzarella. The high-moisture just splits the second you put it in the oven, but low-moisture, it's a lot more forgiving. It's easier to cook with. And I've been to the pizza restaurant that my friends own in Cronulla, and they use the low-moisture, so I feel backed up by the pizza restaurants on that opinion. They're like a traditional Italian one as well. So, you know.
Nice. Oh my God. Okay.
I make a lot of pizza.
Yeah. It's a much more technical answer than we've had previously to that sort of question, but it's great. All right. What would you say is your favorite scientific word or phrase?
The specifics of my research is working on photonic crystals, and I feel like the only way you could make that word cooler would be if you turned them into photonic time crystals.
Time crystals are a thing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Love it.
What is your least favorite scientific word or phrase?
Just the broad concept of adjectives. You see how the astronomers are naming their ever-growing telescopes? You've got the, like, large telescope, then the very large telescope, extremely large telescope. They're going to have to go to, like, the ginormous and then the super-duper enormous next. I feel like they need better words.
The next one's going to be like, seriously, guys, this one's huge telescope.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel very called out, but it's also totally fair. All right, what is your favorite useless science fact?
Ooh, I gotta think about that one.
I think the moose covered it. I think Tycho's moose covered that already. That was awesome.
Yeah, can I call back to that and say that's what it is while I'm thinking? The Tycho Brahe moose. Yeah,
oh, wow. Yeah, that one's going to stay with me for a while.
I have an astronomy-related one. Earth is the only planet we've observed which does anti-accretion. All the other planets suck in mass, but we're the first planet we've ever seen which ejects mass regularly, which is just a really complicated way of saying we have satellites.
Okay.
But that was another one I got from the Alien Life book I've been reading.
I'll take it.
That's
a very
cool one, actually.
Yeah.
If you could rename one planet in our solar system, what would it be?
Take a leaf from the astronomers and name Jupiter the extremely large planet.
I'm loving this.
I'm sorry, that's hands down the best answer we've had to that question. That's great. All right, and finally, if you had to sing one karaoke song to save humanity from an alien invasion, what would it be?
Is the saving criteria entertainment or skill? Because, like, there'd be very different answers.
I think this is like a show me what you got kind of, like.
Show me what you got. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because if I can turn it into a comedy routine, I feel like I could do, like, Taylor Swift's Love Story pretty funnily. But I don't think I could impress anyone with it.
Come on. Show us what you got. They're waiting. You got to decide.
I think that might have a similar outcome to what you were describing before with, like, the quantum communication thing where the aliens just decide not to bother with us.
Maybe. Yeah, no.
We only want to destroy advanced civilizations. These guys. Oh, man, this has been so much fun. Yeah. thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been good fun.
Well, it has been. Thank you.
If folks want to find you online or read more about your research, where would be the best place for them to look?
My website is caffeineandlasers.com. That's where I post all my thoughts.
Nice.
Here it is.
And Benjamin, where can the good people find you?
Just look up Science Actually on all your favorite social media, especially Facebook. That's the big one. Daily science facts, daily collective nouns, and you can find out when the next episode of this fabulous podcast is airing. And also, you can see us on Instagram and TikTok and all the others. How about you, Kavi?
Folks can find me on all the good social media platforms as well as the bad ones, at Fun Fact Science. Feel free to drop us a message about what you thought of this episode or previous episodes or what you want to see in terms of future content or guests. And we will see you all next time, next episode of Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Cameron, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You gotta get swifty in here. It's time to get swifty.
Get swifty? What the hell is that?
It's our world's best effort, that's what.
Take off your pants and your panties. Shit on the floor. Time to get swifty in here. I'm Mr. Bulldog.
Mr. Bulldog?
Don't analyze it, Nathan. It's working.
Take a shit on the floor. Time to get swifty in here.
I like what you got. Good job.
Yeah!